The Senate Committee on Judiciary will come to order. Senator Murphy has usually for our first meeting, you know, we tend to do introductions and things like that. But my good friend Senator Murphy has family matter that he needs to attend to, and I want to accommodate him. So we will do introductions and other things once we have dealt with Senator Murphy's bill, because we want to get him out of here. Not that we don't like him, but we want to accommodate him and get him out of here. Today, we have one bill to consider, Senate File 16. Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, committee members, there is an A2 amendment, and Mr. Backus has it. If someone on the committee would offer it up, it will get the bill in the shape that we need to have it and to present the bill.
Senator Murphy, I think the amendment would make sense in the context of once you've explained the bill.
Okay.
Then we'll do the amendment, because I think it would make more sense.
Okay. That's
Thank
fine.
You.
Thank you, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Murphy.
Madam Chair and committee members, Senate File 16 is the first of several safety measures that the Senate Transportation Committee is going to tackle again this year. The issue of whether seatbelt requirements should be a primary offense or a secondary offense has been in front of the legislature for many years now. I know that Senator Foley has carried it in the past. Senators Hottinger, several other folks have seen the need to pass a primary seatbelt bill, and all of those efforts have basically laid the groundwork for where we're at today. And I think where we're at today is that the Senate and hopefully the House, and I know for a fact that the Senate, you know, we've passed this bill in the past. We're very well of what the statistics are and where we can save lives on our roads. This bill will save lives, and I do believe that Minnesota is much like many of the other states that have went to a primary law, that if you go to a primary law, you will see an increase in seatbelt compliance. And if you just run the numbers of how many people die on Minnesota roads, this past year it was right around 480. If you just run the numbers, we could save 40 to 60 lives in Minnesota by doing this one bill. And I think that doing the one bill is a good way to save 40 to 50 or 60 lives in Minnesota. With that, members, Section 1 of the bill goes through and it defines exactly who is required to buckle up. This bill mandates that everyone in the vehicle be buckled up. Under old laws, it was front seat. Now we're going with everyone. It also sets up a procedure by which the individuals who are violating the primary seatbelt law would be fined, and the distribution of those fines. Let's see here. Section 2 basically talks about people who are under age 18 and they're on an instructional permit. A lot of that language that was struck is due because now we're going to require everyone to be buckled, and under our old law, for drivers of vehicles that were on a provisional license, everyone had to be buckled up. And all we're saying here is we're striking that language so that the law is consistent whether you're on a provisional license or on a regular driver's license. So it's going to be everybody all the time. Section 3 talks about the provisional license. You know, Section 2 talked about the instruction permit. Section 4 talks about surcharges. And those are the surcharges that are put on every moving violation in the state of Minnesota. Madam Chairman, and that's basically where our committee was struggling on how to set up a fine structure so that if someone was pulled over, if someone was pulled over and say that there was a an adult driving the car and three riders that were 15 years old or younger, what would happen? Under 15. And we decided that in that case, the driver should have to pay the penalty for not having those younger passengers buckled up. It's kind of tough to find somebody that's 10 years old, but you can definitely get their parent or whoever the adult is that was driving the car. So if there's four people in the car and you've got, your licensed driver and you have four people who are, say, 8, 10, and 11, the driver is going to get the he's going to have to pay the fines. They're also going to have to pay what's referred to as a surcharge. In the amendment, we talk about moving that surcharge to $25, and I think between Mr. Backus and Mr. Turner, they can explain why we're moving it from 20 to 25. They can do a much better job at that than I can. But the point is that we want to get people's attention, but we don't want to break somebody because they weren't wearing their seatbelt. We found through increased fines in other areas of these chapters of law that we do get a better compliance rate. We do end up getting people's attention, and that's definitely what we want with this bill. Members, I tried as best I can to kind of explain the bill and what this amendment would do. And there's a couple folks here that want to testify to the urgency and the need for passing this bill. And Senator Mwai, however you want to do it.
Senator Murphy, let us put the A2 amendment on. Let's see, Senator Olson moves the A2 amendment. Let the record reflect that we now have a quorum. Mr. Backus, why don't you walk us through the A2 amendment and how it affects the bill as it came to us from the Transportation Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The A2 amendment does three things. On line 1.2, it increases the surcharge in the bill for a violation of the seatbelt law from $20 to $25. And the reason for that is it fits in better with the current distribution scheme for these surcharges. And that's in the next section. Beginning on line 1.4, it adds a new section, Section 5, which addresses the disbursements, and it adds a new paragraph there just to clarify that these surcharges are distributed under paragraph A of that subdivision, which provides that 1% goes to the Game and Fish Fund for peace officer training for employees of the DNR who are licensed peace officers, 39% goes to the peace officer training account for the Post Board for training, and then 60% goes to the general fund, and that's more consistent with current law. And then it adds a new section 6, which is the effective date, and it picks a non-typical effective date of June 9th, 2007. And Senator Murphy can speak more to that, but one main reason is to get the bill in effect before July 1 so that we qualify for federal funding.
Right. And, Madam Chairman, as to the effective date, a constituent of mine, Kathy Cooper, who has been working this issue for a long time, had lost her daughter because she was not buckled in, and she lost her daughter on June 9th. And Madam Chairman, Ms. Cooper was between Ms. Cooper and Senator Langseth, they were instrumental in kind of swinging my opinion around about the use of, the primary issue. I've always been a supporter of making sure that everybody's buckled up, but there was a time when, I was kind of on the other side of the issue, but I've seen the light now, and this is kind of one way to acknowledge Ms. Cooper. And members, just so you know that Catherine Swanson is with us today, and she's been instrumental in leading the charge to get the primary seatbelt provision into law. And this is after the governor signs this, hopefully sometime before the end of session, we'll all be able to refer to this as a Swanson law.
Senator Betzel. Well,
Madam Chair, Senator Murphy, do we know what day of the week June 9th falls on? Is that – I don't have my calendar before me.
Senator Madam Chairman, Senator Betzel, somebody's telling me Saturday.
Okay.
Senator Betzel.
Whatever day of the week it happens, it is sort of odd. I think you'll acknowledge to pick, you know, a day in the, you know, middle of the month, and there may be a tragedy associated with it, but there's probably people that, as you've often said, die in the roads every day, mm-hmm. and so why we should choose one day over the other. I can understand you wanting to have it in advance of July 1st, but I don't know that June 9th, you know, it does look strange to do that. You know, if it was June 30th, they could make the argument, you know, well, that's, you know, that it's a logical date. We choose at the beginning of the month, the end of the month, when bills come into effect, mm-hmm. but not a date like this. I also hope that, again, you know, you may want to pay tribute to an individual, you know, by trying to name a bill after that person. I hope we resist that because, you know, again, there's other tragedies in the state, and why to single out a particular one and say, well, we're going to dedicate a law to that person, I think is a bad precedent, and I've resisted doing that in the past. So I'd rather not have it on June 9th, June 1st, June 30th, you know, but I don't know the June 9th, you know, you may feel strongly about it, but I don't know that that's something I like. So.
Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions, if I could. Senator Murphy, the $20 or $25 surcharge is on top of the $72 surcharge. It replaces the $72.
Senator Murphy.
Madam Chairman, you are correct. It would replace the $72.
It would replace... But, Senator Murphy, I don't think that's the way it's drafted. If you look on page 3, section 4, $72 is referenced on line 16 of page 3, but the $20 surcharge is new language on lines 19 and 20.
Senator Higgins, perhaps counsel can help clarify that.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members, I think if you read the sentence beginning on page 3, line 15, it says, except as provided in this paragraph, the surcharge is $72 on any person convicted of a felony, gross misdemeanor, misdemeanor, or petty misdemeanor other than a parking ordinance, which is for, and other than a violation of this, which is for, so it's 20. So
there should be, Madam Chair, there should be a comma after... Or right at the beginning of the new language, then the $4 goes with the parking.
Which line are you referring to, Senator
Higgins?
I'm
sorry, I'm out of habit. Line 3.19. The $4 surcharge goes with the vehicle parking, and then the new language is the new language goes with the $20 surcharge. I guess I shouldn't get hung up on commas. I'm just having a hard time reading it.
Madam Chair, there's a comma on line 18, so it's other than a violation. So maybe to be consistent after surcharge on line 19, if you want to insert another comma, perhaps that would be clearer.
All right, Ms. Backus, for the record, can you just...
Madam Chair, members, the amendment would be on page 3, line 19, after surcharge, insert a comma.
Senator Higgins, you want to move that that oral amendment?
Can we just incorporate it into? Yes, I'll move it.
Any further discussion since Senator Higgins' oral amendment? Seeing none. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those not, say nay. The amendment passes.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the A2 amendment, but I'd like to change the effective date to June 30, 2007.
Senator Betzel, the A2 amendment has already been moved by Senator Olson, Senator Betzel.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize that. Okay. Well, I'd like to move to amend the A2 amendment to insert June 30 on 1.31.
On line 1.31, Senator Betzel wants to amend June 9th to June 30th. Senator Murphy, do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, Madam Chairman, moving it to June 30th still puts us in line to get the federal money. My preference is to leave it at June 9. I understand Senator Betzel's heartburn over the effective date, but, you know, I really don't think it matters much whether it's on the 30th or the 9th, so I'd like to see it stay on the 9th.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, did we pass the A2 amendment, or is that still pending?
It's still pending, Senator Foley.
Well, then we would not want to take up something else then at this point, but we resolved it.
Senator Foley, I think Senator Betzel wants to amend the A2 amendment before we take action on the A2 amendment to amend the bill.
Well, Madam Chair, we have the A2 amendment before us, and I think we should dispose of that. And I have an amendment to the amendment, so I think we need to deal with that rather than going off to other things. So I'll renew my motion to change on the A2 amendment, page 1, line 31, to read June 30.
Any further discussion? Senator Olson.
I don't have any strong feelings about this one way or the other, Madam Chair. I would only say that sometimes it helps to bring to the public's attention the reason for an issue if you relate it to a specific event, and it brings it, maybe makes it more personal to people in general and maybe understanding the reason why we needed to do this.
All right, on Senator Betzel's amendment to the amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Nay. I think the amendment does not pass. On the A2 amendment, Senator Olson, is there any further discussions? Senator Olson renews her motion on the A2 amendment. All those in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay. The amendment passes. Now.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Could I ask another question of Senator Murphy?
Yes, Senator Murphy.
Mm-hmm. Senator Murphy, you talked about federal funds that go along with this. Mm-hmm. Could you expand a little on that? And how much money are we talking about? And then the other outstanding question I had was, do you have any sense of how much money will come to the state as a result of the fines and the surcharges that we're putting on?
Senator Higgins, we have two individuals who are going to be testifying on the bill, and I believe that one of the testifiers will answer your first question. So if you can hold off on that. And on the second question, Senator Murphy, should we have fiscal analysts answer that, or do you have the information with you?
Madam Chair, Mr. Turner's expert in that field. What I can tell you, Madam Chair, just from kind of trying to play around with a few of the numbers myself, Senator Higgins, it's tough to get your hands around. Because now we're moving from just not front seat violators, but everybody. So now you're going to encapsulate more people in that vehicle, even though the fines are lower. Hopefully through our educational program that continues year-round through driver's training, that, you know, the age demographic that we're aiming for, those 16 to 25-year-olds that represent 25% of all fatal accidents on the road, even though they're way down the list as far as numbers of drivers in that age demographic. I mean, it's disproportionately high. And those are the people that we're trying to get at. And through our educational programs, hopefully we can. Is this going to be a loss to the general fund? I'll let Mr. Turner try to answer that as best he can, but I would say it's at best going to be a wash.
Mr. Turner, do you have any information?
Madam Chair, members, we have a preliminary fiscal note that it's been prepared that hasn't analyzed this yet. But as Senator Murphy said, this is a new violation. So even though the surcharge is lower, logically you'd think that it would be a bit of a wash. But we will request a fiscal note from the Department of Finance before we go to the Finance Committee.
Unfortunately, you know, in the policy committee, Senator Higgins, we don't get the fiscal notes prepared for us. So this will get addressed, I think, in the finance committee, which is where this bill will be going. Thank you. Let's have our testifiers come up to the table. Senator Murphy, if it's okay with you, I'd like to start with Chief Harrington, and then we'll end with Ms. Burkmore with her information, because that will allow you then to answer Senator Higgins' question. Is that all right? I'm happy that this being my first committee hearing, that my police chief is here as one of the first people in the community to come testify before this committee. So, Chief Harrington, welcome.
Thank you very much, Senator Moore. Appreciate it, and members of the committee. I want to tell you that I appreciate the opportunity to be here today because I, like the senator, I think was somewhat ambivalent about primary seatbelt at one point, but in the last 2.5 years, I have seen the carnage that the lack of the primary seatbelt has caused. To give you just a couple of examples, right after I took office on White Bear and 3rd Street, we had an evening where an individual was being chased by the squad for an auto theft. He smashed into a van with a man with two children. Both children were launched out of the van, landed some 30 feet down the road from the car. We were fortunate in that particular occasion that both the children lived. In last year at Rice and Orange, we were not as fortunate, as a T-bone accident happened there and another infant was launched out of the car, and in that case, the child did not live. Within the last week, our first fatality of the year down on East Minnehaha Avenue near White Bear occurred again. The commonality of all three of those events is that in each of those events, the people that were either ejected from the car or unfortunately died were not seatbelted in. And I really do believe that the lack of a primary seatbelt law has hampered the local police department and state agencies' ability to follow up with what I think are the real basics of traffic law enforcement, good enforcement and good education. I think without primary seatbelt, it is very confusing to many motorists to understand that if you're under 16 but under this kind of driver's license, you might get stopped, but if you're over 18 and you're not, you are probably free and clear. I think it is very confusing for people, and I think this primary seatbelt law will make it less unclear for the motorists, and it will make it much clearer for the police department to be able to enforce this law. I also think that it's good policy. What we see is there were 559 people killed last year. What we know is that 263 of those people killed were not belted in. How many of those people would have been saved if they had been belted in? We can only guess, but I think we can make a reasonable hypothesis that we'd have had far fewer fatalities if they'd been belted in. 35,000 people were injured in car accidents last year, and around 8,000 of those people that were injured weren't belted in. Once again, the dollars and the time lost to the community, the tragic, the injuries, the pain and suffering of those individuals, I think are all very compelling reasons why we as a community should want primary seatbelt enforcement. In the local jurisdiction, I can tell you that we have seen the need for primary seatbelt enforcement, and my officers have told me that it is very confusing and it's very difficult for them to take enforcement action the way the law is currently configured. And I really do believe you will get much more consistent, much more fair, and much broader enforcement, and therefore much higher compliance if we have primary seatbelt.
For the record, this is Chief John Harrington from the St. Paul Police Department. Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chief, is it easy or difficult to determine whether or not individuals in a car are wearing a seatbelt, particularly at night or during times of limited visibility? Is that something that can be easily spotted?
Chief Harrington?
Senator, no. At night, it is much more difficult to be able to spot whether or not someone is wearing a seatbelt during the hours of darkness or if there's limited visibility or we have very dark tinted window.
So,
Senator Betzel?
Madam Chair and Chief, one of the concerns, I support people wearing the seatbelts, and I think the data about injuries certainly is indisputable, but I think there's also a problem with, say, some peace officers who may pull somebody over under the guise, if you will, of saying, well, I didn't think they were wearing a seatbelt.
Chief Harrington?
I think that it's fairly easy if we make it a primary offense, you know, to make it that, and there's absolutely no other reason to pull somebody over, and I think there's some people that might have some concerns about that.
Chief?
Senator Betzel, Senator Moore, I appreciate that concern, and I can tell you, both as a black police officer and individual who lives in the cities, who has black kids who drive in the cities, that the issue of racial profiling, which I think is what you're alluding to, is a concern of mine. It is a concern. It's one that we train very diligently against in the St. Paul Police Department. I know they train very diligently against it in the post-rules and regulation. Good police practice is that you don't stop a car on a fishing expedition. The gold standard of good police practice is that you have probable cause. And probable cause is not just a fishing expedition. That would mean that for me to pull a car over just to check to see if they had a seatbelt on would be bad police practice. It would show in what we call the hit rate, the number of cars an officer stops and how many times he actually finds what he or she is looking for. So it would be a bad police practice to do what you're describing as stopping people just to check to see if they have seatbelts. Is it difficult to do it in hours of the night? It is certainly more difficult, but it's not impossible. Under good illumination and street lights, squad cars with good spotlights, there are lots of ways that you could do it. But I think what you're going to find is that, number one, officers will not just be stopping cars randomly to check. In addition, I would note that the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement Executives, which is the organization that represents the majority, the vast majority of the black chiefs of police, is fully in support of primary seatbelt. What we know is that more young black men from age 0 to age 18 are killed in car accidents than almost anything else. And so while weighing the issues of racial profiling against the carnage and the death rate among young black males, the black chiefs of police came to the conclusion that primary seatbelt was the right policy direction to go.
Senator Petzl.
I agree with you that it would be a bad police practice to pull somebody over under the guise of, I didn't think they were wearing a seatbelt, but I think it's also possible that while there are many, many, many very good and conscientious officers, there probably are a few that would engage in bad police practices. And my concern is that this, by making a primary offense, opens the door to bad police practices and would sanction some what may be otherwise unlawful stops and searches. That's my concern.
Your concern is registered.
And
Senator Murphy?
Madam Chair, and Senator Betzel, you know, we've both been around here the same amount of time, and I think that, you know, through our life experiences and through the experiences of talking with people like the chief and our state troopers, that I think that we're going to find that if a cop wants to pull you over, Senator Betzel, on your way home, he's probably going to find a reason to. That's why I don't think that this is all that much of a big deal. If a cop sees you going down the road and you're not wearing your seatbelt, that's a real good reason to pull you over, in my opinion. Now, are there officers of the law that may fool around with this a little bit? Well, that could be, but I can tell you that the law enforcement officials that I know, they're going to treat this just like another tool in their toolbox. And that toolbox is there to provide safety on our roads. And I would hope that we load the toolbox to the brim.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chief, could you tell me what triggers a law enforcement officer to stop a vehicle in a primary offense? Do they have to see or observe an illegal action?
Typically, Senator, yes.
If there's a term like probable cause that triggers the action of a law enforcement officer, how does it apply to a primary offense?
Chief?
Senator Limmer, Senator Moore, yes. All traffic stops are based on reasonable suspicion or observable fact. Those are the two basic tenets of traffic law enforcement. So what that typically means for me when I'm driving down the street is I see someone in their car as I'm pulling past them, and I can look over and I can see that they're not wearing a seatbelt. I can see the seatbelt sitting across there. I can see that it's not across their shoulders. So that gives me a reason, because I've actually observed the fact as I pull past them to know that, yes, in fact, they aren't wearing a seatbelt at that time. The other thing that oftentimes will trigger this for most cops is the kids in the car. You will see the kids, they're climbing over the seats, they're bouncing up and down, they're standing up in the back, looking out the back window, and you can tell just by that simple visual observation that, in fact, they're not buckled in because they couldn't possibly be in the positions that they're standing or sitting at that point. So in most cases, what this will amount to is the officer will physically observe a person who does not have the seatbelt on, or you'll see them take action that would not be possible if the seatbelt was affixed. So, for example, it would be very difficult for you to be sitting all the way in the middle of the car with the seatbelt in its normal harness position. You wouldn't be able to reach all the way across the car typically. So those kind of activities would also give officers a clear visual observation that would indicate a stop would be warranted.
Madam Chair and Chief, as you know, a lot of the minivans these days have tinted windows. And other times, other people add tinted windows on as an option that they exercise. It's sometimes difficult to look into a window, especially on a sunny day, to see whether or not a seatbelt is pulled down into the proper position or not. Would you say that that would negate action by a law enforcement officer not to go forward with a stop based on an idea that a seatbelt violation was occurring?
Senator Murphy.
And Senator Limmer, before the chief fills in the blanks here, I can tell you that just about every state trooper out there carries around this little magical wand that they put over the window. And if your windows are too tinted, they write you a fix-it ticket. If they catch it a second time, they write you a ticket. I don't know what happens a third time, because most of the time after people have to pay a fine for having their windows too darkly tinted, they normally remove the tint. There is a standard in the state of Minnesota, and we do that to protect our law enforcement officers. We don't want them walking up and having a guy pointing a gun through the window at them and then not being able to see the gun. That's why those laws are on the books, is to protect our law enforcement officers. There is a law against...
There's a limit on the tent. Is that correct? Okay, I'm getting the nod from the state patrol. And they have to be able to see in it, so... Tinted windows aren't the big deal. The back window of that van, center limit, can't be tinted. And that's just the way it is, because your mirrors don't work right if you put a bunch of that tint stuff on your rear window. So if the law enforcement officer is driving along behind and he sees all the activity that the chief was talking about, kids jumping around and everything, they know they're out of compliance.
Madam Chair.
Pull them over,
write them a ticket.
Madam Chair, Senator Murphy, I'm not talking about necessarily tinted windows or the ability of a police officer to have some monitoring mechanism to judge how tinted the window is. That would predicate a stop. They're not doing it from their car. They're doing it by stopping the vehicle. I'm talking about what necessitates for a law enforcement officer to stop someone, pull them over, stop their forward progression when he can't see a seatbelt at all. Now, maybe you can pull them over for a suspected window tinting violation, but let's say it was snow on a window. Let's say it was at night. How does one justify for a police officer to stop a vehicle when they can't see whether or not the crime was being committed or not? So that's what I want to know. And I've gotten a pretty good idea of what that means. I think the chief said that they have to observe some type of violation, and that justifies a stop. But we know that even factory vehicles come with tinted windows, and as tinted windows, especially at night or at dusk, you can't see through the window to see if that seatbelt is being pulled down in the proper location anyway. Does that mean that the police officer will not stop that car based on a seatbelt issue?
Senator Lindley?
Chief Harrington?
Senator Moore? In essence, yes. If we cannot observe a violation, we don't make a stop. That would be standard practice for the department. We don't do this in any other venue either. If we suspect that someone is, you know, smoking marijuana in a house, but we can't see it and we can't smell it and we don't have someone who was in there to say it, we don't go into the house to effect an arrest. We can have all kinds of suspicions, but what we have to have in order to stop your forward progress, to impede your ability to continue on where you want to go, is I have to have factual or I have to have reasonable suspicion. And that reasonable suspicion in most traffic cases will, in fact, be an observable violation. I may not be able to stop a car that has tinted windows or has snow on the windows or is all iced up for a seatbelt violation. I could still stop that car for obstructed vision, which would be a violation that would still be a legitimate stop. And if I walk up to the car and find that the person is quickly trying to put their seatbelt on as I walk up, I then would still have an observable fact that would allow me to tag for the seatbelt violation. But I wouldn't be able to stop them based on I don't know that they have a seatbelt on because I can't see inside the car. If I can't see inside the car and there's no other violations other than the tent, and I will tell you that we do stop people for the tent, and we do get loud and vociferous arguments from individuals who complain to me that I just bought this car from the Mercedes dealership, and how can they possibly sell me this car with this kind of tent? And what we tell them is that the manufacturer can install all kinds of accessories on the car. Whether or not they're legal to operate on a Minnesota roadway is, in fact, an entirely different issue than what the manufacturer can install on the car.
I think that might be a separate bill, Chief.
Yes, it might be. So.
Senator Olson.
Which I'm not introducing here at all.
Madam Chair, Chief Harrington, I would just like to reiterate a couple of the points that the Chief has made. I would also be concerned about racial profiling if it were not for the fact that I think we are tracking this very carefully in our state through organizations like the ACLU. I've seen presentations they've given, and there does have to be a correspondence between the number of stops made and the outcome of those stops, or someone is going to be answering to someone. And I've seen that we're tracking that quite closely. I've had over 15 years' experience working with families who were injured in automobile accidents. And I would just like to say that reiterate that anecdotally that there can't be any question that we will save lives if we pass this law. I know that we are to some extent limiting individual choices, but when we weigh that against the lives that are being saved, the fact that we will reduce injuries that are impacting insurance rates, and so we can do something to save insurance costs for everyone. We're also protecting children because oftentimes they're the ones who aren't being belted, and they don't have the right or the ability to make those choices for themselves. And we will reduce medical costs. Many of the people who are injured, we are paying those costs through general tax dollars, and we can realize some savings there as well. But I think the bottom line was pointed out to me by someone just as I was walking into this hearing, and that's the fact that we're really made a policy decision earlier to have a mandatory seatbelt law. And we've already had that discussion statewide, and all we're doing is asking that we bring to give law enforcement the same ability to enforce that law as we do with all of our other laws in this state.
On that note, Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I'm just curious. What other kinds of things are secondary offenses that an officer couldn't pull somebody over only for that offense? Or is this just an odd thing that we did whenever we decided to pass a seatbelt law?
Chief?
Senator Moore, Senators, as to the best of my understanding, this is the only secondary offense in existence in Minnesota law. There are no other secondary offenses, and this would, by changing this, would make this much more consistent and, once again, more easy to understand for the motorists and much easier for law enforcement to enforce.
Senator Foley, did you have a question for the Chief?
No, but I agree with what he says. I look at the issue of the seatbelt, currently the way it's structured, why this is the only crime that I know of that a police officer can see a violation and can't do anything about.
Okay.
And I really looked at what Senator Betzel says, but I disagree entirely. I don't think that there's going to be any change in the stopping of individuals because they're wearing a seatbelt or not wearing a seatbelt.
Well, Chief Harrington, thank you so much for coming. And as you can see, we have committee members who are very passionate, and they ask good questions. It's going to be a very rigorous committee. I hope you will come back to visit us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming.
Xin ji duo.
Xin ji duo. That was Hmong for "we'll meet again." Next, we have with us Ms. Catherine Burkmore, who is the Deputy Director of the Office of Traffic Safety for the State of Minnesota. Are we going to try to run our slide program?
Madam Chair, it's totally... Madam Chair, you wanted us to just go off the paper, is that correct? And not
I think all the members have have the slides. Oh, well, there it is. Then go ahead. Go ahead if the slide is on.
I may just leave it up there since I didn't fool with this,
okay.
And we'll just go
Very
through.
Good.
Shall I start introducing myself?
Please, first of all, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Catherine Burkmore. I'm the Deputy Director of the Office of Traffic Safety. I'm Kathy Swanson's Deputy Director, for those of you who know Kathy Swanson quite well. And Senator, Madam Chair had asked me to bring you some facts on seatbelt use in Minnesota. So you all have a packet in front of you, and I thought maybe the best way to do it would just be go slide by slide. Should say Minnesota traffic fatalities. Does everybody have that? Okay, first slide. Really, this is just a snapshot of traffic deaths in Minnesota over the last 20 years. As you can see, in 1985, we were over 600. Today, our preliminary figures for 2006 is 476. Which is actually a great reduction, and we're very pleased with that reduction, yet we're not satisfied that we're still having 476 deaths in Minnesota. That's more than one a day. 476 funerals in Minnesota for preventable accidents. Next slide really compares two unacceptable and unexpected sudden and violent deaths. Homicides and traffic fatalities. We all would like there to be no more homicides. I think sometimes we accept that there will be traffic fatalities, but they're just as unexpected and preventable. And you can see by this graph that there's 5 to 6 times more traffic fatalities than fatalities by homicide in Minnesota each year. The next slide shows observed seatbelt use in Minnesota. This is one way that we have achieved that reduction in fatalities that you saw on the first slide, is by getting more and more people to buckle up. Right now, we are at 83% seatbelt use. 17% of our vehicle occupants still do not buckle up. Yes, we've made progress. You can see that back in 1985, before we had a seatbelt law at all, we had about a 20% use rate. But you can also see by the end of that graph that we really have plateaued. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in later slides.
Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel.
Could I ask a question? Okay, well, what methodology did you use to come up with these numbers on observed seatbelt use?
We actually have, there's actually a NHTSA observational survey methodology that is used in every state in the United States to observe their seatbelt use. So we have trained observers that are in different spots across Minnesota actually looking into vehicles as they go by and actually at an intersection so you can see into a vehicle and marking down seatbelt use.
Senator Betzel.
Is there a difference between metro areas and rural areas? Or how do you break?
As far as use rate?
More?
Yes.
Well,
yes. Yeah. There is some, but not a huge difference. The difference is, as you can see in later slides, the bigger difference is between age group and gender. That's our largest difference in use rate.
Please continue, Ms.
Well,
Burkmore.
I got another follow-up
Senator
question.
Betzel.
how can you observe age group with whatever observation you're using?
Spoke more.
In the observation studies, we actually do not get specific as to age because we couldn't. We do have our observers only observe or make an estimate of over 30, under 30. But where that percentage comes is actually in our crash victims. That's where we look at usage rate and age, because then we have detail about who was in a crash and who was and was not wearing the belt.
Please continue with your presentation, Ms. Berkmore.
We're on the slide which has the three different partitions for observed use. I want to show you what caused use rate to go up. Obviously, the first thing when we went from 20 to over 30 was a seatbelt law. Before that, there was no seatbelt law in Minnesota. The next jump was in 1988 when there's a $10 fine imposed by the legislature. And then the next jump was in 1991 when that fine was increased to $25. In the early 90s and throughout for about 10 years, well, we were still doing it, we really ramped up enforcement and education about seatbelt use. We have grants to law enforcement to enforce the seatbelt. We also make sure that the public knows that enforcement is happening. We also make sure that we do a lot of education throughout the state with a lot of our partners, law enforcement agencies, public health agencies, educators, so people know the benefits of wearing a seatbelt. So we did get, in that orangish box, additional increases in seatbelt use, and we're proud of that. If we look into the green box, went up a little smidge more, and part of that was now national campaigns. There's a click-it-or-ticket campaign. You may have heard that. We both advertised it in Minnesota. It was done statewide. All states did it at the same time, so there's a lot of recognition of both the message and the idea, buckle up. We were also allowed to spend more money. Our NHTSA funds come with rules of how we can spend it. We could actually spend money on advertising, which we weren't able to before. And so we got a little bit of a bump. But you can also tell in those last 4 or 5 years, we've really plateaued. What we've done has got the people who are going to buckle up and comply with the law to buckle up. Next slide just shows that plateau and the gap, that 17% that aren't buckling up. We just don't seem to be able to get to move them. Next slide has, you'll see a graph with a blue and a red line. The blue line, again, shows the observed seatbelt use in Minnesota. What the red line shows is belted fatalities. 40% of the fatalities right now are belted. What that's showing us is 60% of our folks dying are dying because they're not wearing belts. A primary seatbelt law, increasing the use of the seatbelt, would lower that amount of people, lower the number of people dying overall, but also increase the number of people wearing seatbelts. So the next slide shows the gap in the lower spot. What we're trying to do is get rid of that gap of the people not wearing seatbelts, and so we also lower fatalities. Now, that's talking about fatalities as if they're just numbers. But the next thing we really need to talk about, these are people. These are people's mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, next-door neighbors, coworkers. And we can't forget that. These are not just statistics. There have been at least 476 funerals in Minnesota in 2006 due to traffic fatalities. Who's dying? The young. 25% of people dying are between the age of 15 and 24. 61% are under the age of 41. I just find that's not when you expect people to die. Men, 67% of the fatalities are men. So now we are at 67%. We've got young men dying. Rural, although seatbelt use is generally the same percentage in all areas of the state, 72% of our fatalities are in rural areas. Interesting also is that 35% of the crashes are alcohol are impaired, not necessarily just alcohol, but are due to impairment. And 29% of the non-belted are the crash had speed as a contributing factor. huge gender gap is the next. The next slide actually illustrates the gender gap. If we could get men to buckle up, we'd be in a lot better shape. Women generally tend to buckle up more, but when after they turn the teenage years is when the men stop buckling up. Obviously, parents are probably not as in control of those kids, and that continues. The next slide, I'm actually going to have you just pass, for time's sake, set aside. And you're going to come to another one, which is the percentage of restraint use for occupants of fatal drivers in alcohol-impaired crashes. This one we just find very interesting. You all know that the legal limit for alcohol is 0.08. And it's interesting if you look at this chart that when that the more impaired the driver is, the less likely they are to buckle up. Their judgment even as to clicking that belt goes down as they are belted. So it's just really interesting to us to see that impairment, how low, if you're impaired, how low that seatbelt use is. The next slide actually illustrates that speeding contributor factor. And what you'll see again, and it also compilates it with age. You'll see that it's actually the young that are speeding, and that speeding without a seatbelt, speeding is not good at any times, but without a seatbelt, the laws of physics will take over, and it's very common in a high-speed crash, no seatbelt, fatality or very serious injuries. But again, it's not just people dying, and that's where I think we get a lot to the idea of is it my right to not wear a seatbelt? It only affects me. But we look at what's the cost of non-seatbelt use? Who else does it affect? And it does in the cost. Who pays the price? Well, of course, there's a price of losing someone. So families lose. 500 is destined. We think that the final numbers in 2006 may be up closest as to 2006, but 260 unbelted. More than half of those fatalities were not belted. How would that number be different if they were all belted? Businesses pay the price. Motor vehicle crashes add $16.3 billion to health-related portions of employees' fringe benefits costs. $16.3 billion. $7.7 billion for their health care costs. We all pay that. $8.6 billion for sick leave, life and disability insurance benefits for crash victims. Society. Nationally, crashes result in $230.6 billion in economic loss. 85% of the medical costs are borne by society, Medicare, Medicaid, and other taxpayer-funded sources pay 24% of these costs. When crash victims are unbuckled, their medical costs are also 50% higher than crash victims who are belted. What do we know about belts? Belt use saves lives. As Senator Murphy said, we would expect at least 40 lives saved from a primary seatbelt law. They keep families intact, and they save money. Strong enforcement of strong laws increases seatbelt use. It changes driver and passenger behavior. NHTSA studies and experience in other states strongly suggest that a stronger law will increase seatbelt use in Minnesota. We would anticipate approximately a 10% increase. We're at 83. We would expect to go to 93% use with a primary seatbelt. What else do we know? Next slide. Our strong enforcement efforts have kind of reached a point of diminishing returns. As you can see, despite putting more and more grant funding, getting more and more agencies to participate in our enforcement programs and communities to actually educate their local residents, we seem to have plateaued. That the group that's not buckling up isn't listening to that message anymore. Belt use dropped slightly in 2006. We've been on their way up. We were at 84%. We're now slipping down to 83%. 1 percentage point doesn't seem like much, but we're going down, and we need to be going up. Incentives. There was a question asked earlier. I can quickly go over. There are actually The slide only shows one. There are actually two incentive grants that can come to Minnesota's way. The one on the slide is $15 million. The $15 million is a one-time grant, and we would, as long as the law is in place on June 30th or earlier, we would qualify for it. And it can be used for any highway infrastructure use, but at least $1 million has to be used towards behavioral safety, so educating, etc. There's also another grant that we would qualify for if the bill that Senator Murphy has proposed passes. The two parts that are important in that bill is that, first of all, it's primary enforcement, and it also applies to all passengers in the vehicle. Currently, our law only applies to people in the back seat under 10 and under. So if we only made it primary and did not change that passenger to include all of them, we would not qualify for this grant. But the way the law is written, proposed, we would. That's another $1.6 million in federal fiscal year 08. But it continues to $960,000 in 09 and $640,000 in federal fiscal year 10, not 010. This funding may be used only to implement and enforce occupant protection programs. We can do a lot of education. We can use it to educate the public and to advertise new laws and to help implement the law.
Are there any questions? Ms. Burkmore, can you go back and Senator Higgins, was your question with respect to the federal incentives answered?
Or yes.
Do you want, very good. Did you have another question?
I have another question, though.
Senator Higgins?
I'm curious about the occupant protection programs you were just talking about. I had a conversation with another senator a couple of weeks ago about the cars where you have to punch in the right code before you can start the car being used for people who've had DWIs. Would, if we wanted to look at a program to require that of people who had a first DWI to keep them from getting a second DWI, would that grant money be available to use for a program like that?
Ms. Burkmore?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I'm going to look at the two different grants here. The 15.2 is behavioral. Traffic safety behavioral issue. It's not unique to seatbelts, so yes. And that 15.2 doesn't say only $1 million. It can be up to $1 million. Must be spent on behavioral safety. The other, the 1.6 or 1.6 million, that one is specific to occupant protection. Does that answer your question? Was that as clear as mud?
That would work for the DWI proposal or some DWI kind of proposal as well.
Yes. Okay. Again, the 15.2.
Very good. Are there any further discussions, questions for Ms. Burkmore? Thank you very much for coming in and providing us with this information. Is there any further discussion on Senate File 16 as amended? Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can't let this go without saying how wonderful it is that Senator Murphy is bringing this bill forward. That I, 11 years ago, inherited the bill from someone else, and then someone else took it back. And so this is an issue for me that I really feel that this is a wonderful law and that will do matters to reduce the safety of the occupants. And I really the only thing that I'm not really thrilled about in the law is that you have on page one a restriction that says the department will not record a violation of this subdivision than a person's driving record. And I think that that shouldn't be in there, but I'm not going to move to remove it because I want to see this bill passed and leave that for another day. Thank you.
My good friend Senator Betzold has reminded me that many times we have community members who are here to testify on bills, which they might not know that they should notify us. So is there anybody in the audience who's here to testify on this bill that we don't know about and are sitting out there? We would like to give you the chance to do that. All right. Very good. And is there any further discussion on Senate File 16? Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, I'm like Senator Murphy. I have opposed this in many years past. And at some point, a citizen who came to talk to me about it said something about the Urban League and the NAACP and a lot of organizations that represent a lot of folks who live in my district. We're supporting the primary seatbelt, and I said, well, that can't possibly be right. And so I actually called over to the Urban League and talked to the executive director, and he said, well, that can't possibly be right. Let me check. And he called back in a few minutes, and he had talked to the National, and he said, yes, of course, I guess we're supporting this because young African-American teenagers are disproportionately affected by not wearing seatbelts when they drive. So, after thinking a lot and talking to a lot of people, I am going to support this, and I think it's a good way to get us where we need to get, which is everybody needs to wear a seatbelt. And my parents had a place in Texas for a lot of years, and they became every time seatbelt drive users long before I did. And it's because they had to half the year when they were in their other house. And I'm hoping that we can pass it this year. And thank you, Senator Murphy, for doing this.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I move that Senate File 16 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Is there any further discussion on Senator Olson's motion? See none. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say no.
No. No.
The motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members.
Thank you, Senator Murphy. Have a safe trip.
Thank you.
Wear your seatbelt.
I always do.
Right. We wouldn't want to lose you.
Yeah. Members, before you all leave, I know that this is our first meeting, and I would have liked to do introductions. Before we leave, I know that we have one new member to the Senate who's on our committee. Ooh. We also have a number of new staff members who are here. And so I thought, I know that we all know each other because many of us have been here for a while, but I think it'd be kind of neat to just get to know each other better. And then I have a couple of housekeeping things that I want to deal with before we adjourn the committee. So, for introductions, what I would like is I'd like to start with just the members, and I'd like to start with Senator Foley. Go around the table. I'd like you to tell us, obviously, your name, the Senate district that you represent, and then give us a city where you were born and all the cities where you've lived. All right?
Well, you were kidding.
Yes. So very quickly. And then just the members. And then we'll start with the staff introduction. Senator Foley.
I have to leave, so I'm not going to give you the life history of where I've lived. But I will say that I'm Leo Foley. I'm chairman of the Senate district, or I'm in 47, which includes Coon Rapids, Champlin, and Brooklyn Park. And I've been in the Senate for a little more than 10 years and been on the crime prevention policy and the budget division all of those years, and most of the time was on judiciary. And I'm currently on the judiciary funding division, so... where I lived, I'm currently living less than 2 miles from where I was born. I grew up in that area and attended a consolidated school at 8 grades, and I graduated from Anoka High School went to school at Northwestern University. I had a master's degree in Mankato, a law degree from William Mitchell, and I currently work as a prosecutor for the County of Anoka. And I would only say that dealing with this seatbelt thing, that that you have to know that police officers are going to feel better about it because of the fact that they know that we care more about stopping this kind of thing and saving lives this way. Otherwise, what's the sense of doing anything?
Very good. Thank you. And obviously, my name is Mi Mo, and I represent Senate District 67. I have to tell you that it's a tremendous honor for me to chair this committee. It is humbling to be among the stellar prior chairs, the likes of, you know, Senator Amber Reichgott Young, Senator Jane Ranum, Senator Don Betzold. And so I hope that I can do justice by my predecessors who have chaired this committee so well. I was born in Laos. I lived in a refugee camp in Thailand. Then I lived in Providence, Rhode Island. I've lived in Wisconsin, in Texas, and now I am really, really happy to be living in Minnesota. I am so happy that it has snowed. Senator Olson.
I'm Mary Olson. I'm very honored as well to be a member of this committee, and to be serving as the vice chair is really a privilege. I was born in Wilmer only because a little town called Sundberg wasn't large enough to have its own hospital. So that's where I started. I lived very briefly in Duluth until my family moved to Bemidji when I was 5. So I grew up in Bemidji, spent a brief period of time in Moorhead when I attended Concordia College, and then finished college and law school in Grand Forks. I moved north to Carlstead, Minnesota, another very small town, for a couple of years. Then lived in Riverside, California area for 4 years while I was serving in the Air Force JAG. Returned to the Brainerd area, lived there about 12 years, and then moved back to my hometown of Bemidji about 6 years ago. So I've mostly lived in north central Minnesota.
We see that. Senator Limmer?
Madam Chair, you probably get the award for traveling the farthest.
It's hard to top that.
Hard to top loss. Well, among the variety of places I've lived, I've passed through South Dakota, Nebraska, and Minnesota. And
where were you born?
I'm not going to tell you where. I want to keep mystery.
Data practices.
Data practices committee must rule. I can't say I was raised in a log trailer home at one time.
Go say it.
And by way of St. Cloud State University, got my BA degree in criminal justice. At one time, entertained the idea of wanting to be an attorney.
What?
hard to believe, and the grace of God saved me from that title.
And
we'll still keep you on the committee,
and,
Senator
Well,
Limmer.
Nevertheless, despite my wannabe attorney status, I've managed to be on a judiciary committee all 18 years of my legislative life. And I take that as a compliment because the subject matter that is discussed in judiciary is far-ranging, as you know, and it sometimes gets very complex, and it gets very contentious, and I'm glad I've spent that time. I enjoy that type of atmosphere.
And tell us about your time in the workhouse.
Senator Foley, we allow this to be a personal disclosure for this exercise.
Madam Chair, I do have to put a footnote on what Senator Foley said. I was employed there as a correction officer. I want to make sure people knew that.
Let me say that I'm honored to have Senator Limmer serving in this committee as the ranking member of the Minority Caucus. So, Senator Betzold.
I'm Don Betzold. I've been on the Judiciary Committee since I was first elected in 1992, continuously, and it was my honor and pleasure to chair it for the last term of the legislature. I currently am on the Judiciary Budget Division, chaired by Senator Foley. I chair the State Government Budget Division and on the State Government Policy Committee, chaired by Senator Rest, and then I'm also on the Finance Committee. I was born at Fairview Hospital and raised in Senator Higgins' district in North Minneapolis. Both my parents were from North Minneapolis, and they built a house out in the middle of the field, which is 51st and Aldrich, which is well-developed right now. But I can remember being able to look down to Fremont and seeing empty spaces, you know, so I remembered growing up. I lived there and through going to college at the University of Minnesota. Then I went into the Army as an Army officer. I was in Germany and lived in Weiningen, Germany, and then Worms, Germany, until I came back home and lived in St. Paul while I was going to law school. Lived briefly in Blaine, which I represent now. I was kind of scoping it out. And then moved into Fridley, and I've been in Fridley since actually 1980. So not as far as Laos.
Senator Higgins.
I'm Linda Higgins, and I'm from District 58, and that's North Minneapolis and about half of downtown Minneapolis. And I'm like Senator Olson. I was born in Algona, Iowa, only because Titonka, Iowa was too small to have a hospital. And I grew up in Titonka. Population 500 on a good day, and sometimes you had to count the cats and dogs to get that. I went to college in Estherville, Iowa for 2 years, and then up to Mankato State, where I graduated with a BS in English and a minor in journalism. And then, of course, there being no jobs in Titonka, Iowa for English majors or journalism majors. I moved up here and lived in St. Louis, St. Louis Park for 5 years, then moved to the north side. And I used to run into Don's mom at National Night Out parties, and she was still up on that corner for quite a while.
My mom and my sister moved into Brighton a few years ago.
I chair the Crime Prevention Budget Division. And I have lived in fear for 10 years of having a bill come to the Judiciary Committee. So it's really, really strange that now I'm on the Judiciary Committee.
I'm a volunteer for this, I take it.
Yeah, and the only thing that could have been even stranger is if you had put me on the Data Practices Subcommittee, and God, I hope you didn't. Who is on the Data Practices Subcommittee?
Senator Higgins.
Refused to serve.
Let's just say that I, too, have had a couple of bills that have not come out of Judiciary, and I hope that now my bills could make it out of the Judiciary Committee.
Madam Chair, I had trouble getting bills through my committee. They weren't nice to me either.
So. There was a reason why. I was on the organizing committee. We took a poll, and we said, who the members who've never gotten bills out of the Judiciary Committee shall now sit on the Judiciary Committee?
That would be me and V, right?
That's right.
No, it's her shy.
Shy?
We beat her up.
Now that the members have introduced themselves, I just have to say that I am very proud to be chairing a committee that probably has some of the best professional staff here at the Senate. I mean, by far in practice and by reputation, in fact. And so I'm going to start with Mr. Backus here and let them introduce themselves. And, no, you don't have to tell us where you were born and where you live.
Oh, but,
come on.
Do tell us how long you've been with the Senate.
My name is Ken Backus. I'm the counsel for the committee. This is my 13th year. And I want to tell you where I was born.
Okay.
Right?
All right.
I was born in the Bronx, New York City. I grew up in New York City and lived there for 30 years and been here for the last dozen years. And I'm very happy here.
That's what everyone think about New York. Mr. Turner?
My name's Chris Turner. This is my 17th session. I'm the fiscal analyst for the Criminal Justice Committee. And I was born and raised in Minnesota.
Darn good place.
I'm Kathy Pontius, counsel for the Committee for the Civil Law Provisions, and it's a much kinder, gentler committee than it used to be. Because when I first started, it was when crime and civil law were all together. There were 17 members on the committee, and it was quite intimidating. I mean, you had the likes of, you know, Bill Luther and Jim Ransted and Mike Freeman were on it, and I could go on. It was it is a lot.
Gene Merriam
was on it. Randy Peterson was on it. Fritz Knock. Alan Spear was chair, so it was a lot different.
I would have never gotten a bill for that.
Oh, I was afraid to be sitting at the table. Yeah. Somebody's going to ask me a question. But,
We are being taped.
Where are you
born? Members, we are being taped. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Poldermiller does remember the days when he'd say you present a bill and then the member would just leave and let the committee, you know, deal with it for a few hours and then come back later. And, you know, he said at least they'd let you leave with your dignity, you know. That's all you're left with, though, so, right. We don't do that anymore.
Well, thank you. I also want to let you know that in addition to the professional staff, of course, we have my staff. Next to me here is Sheila Shong, who is the L.A., for the committee, and then Regina Garza. Regina, wave your hand. Please, you know, feel free to talk to them, use them, ask them questions. I mean, treat them like your staff, except let them do a little bit of work for me, too. We also have a committee page. Brittany Edwards is going to be helping us in the committee. And then also at the table, I believe we have Megan Johnson, who is the research for the DFL caucus. And I don't see the research for the Republican caucus here. And then Alice is with Senator Higgins' office. She's sitting in with us today. And I think that's it. I don't think we have any heads of departments or agencies here. We didn't ask them to come. But just in case they were curious about this fantastic committee and they were here, we would introduce them. Members, that's our business for the day. We have lots of tours that we have coordinated both with the House and with Senators Foley's committee and Senator Higgins' committee. Pay attention to that, and we will let you know about the next committee hearing date. Thank you, and the committee now stands adjourned.